welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Turn the Page. I'm your host today, Jen, and I am joined by a fantastically talented writer who graciously shared a novel with me that I have really not been able to stop thinking about since I read it, and I am so excited to talk about it. Welcome to the show. Could I ask you to introduce yourself and your book, please?
Sure. Thank you. And I'm delighted to be joining the show. My name is Kathleen Jones, and I'm the author of Cities of Women. It's a dual timeline novel that explores the quest of a modern disillusioned professor of history named Verity Fraser, who becomes enchanted with the illuminated manuscripts of Christine de Pizan and determined to prove that the artist responsible for some of the most famous paintings in the Book of the City of Ladies was a woman named Anastasia. And we follow both Verity's story and Anastasia's story in the novel.
They're both such beautiful stories, and they speak to each other in such interesting ways. Before we get into the book itself that much, I was wondering if you could start by telling us a little bit about your career and your journey to this book.
Sure. I worked at San Diego State University for more than two decades. I was a professor in the Department of Women's Studies, teaching about women in politics. And in the middle of my academic career, I decided that I wanted to experiment with different kind of writing and introduced creative nonfiction into my academic writing first, and then decided that I really wanted to pursue fiction writing full time. And so I left the university to do that and fairly recently returned to school to get my MFA in creative writing. So it's possible to continue lifelong learning.
I, as a, you know, as a chronic student, I really appreciate that perspective. I am currently in library school myself. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why this book appealed to me so much is that, you know, I studied medieval history before I fell into libraries. And I was also, you know, in grad school sort of training to be a part of academia. And so both timelines really spoke to me, and they speak to each other in a lot of interesting ways. So yeah, could you tell us a little bit about perhaps what drew you to this time period and to Christine de Pizan in general? Because I think she's such a fascinating figure and is really kind of in popular history and awareness, I think kind of underexplored and underappreciated.
No, that's very true. I mean, she's really come back into vogue more since the 1970s, when a number of feminist historians rediscovered her. And in fact, some of her works were published in English in the early 1970s. And that spread the word about this late 14th century, early 15th century woman who is fascinating because at the age of 25, when she'd been widowed and left with her three children and a mother to support, she turned to writing. And that's what she enabled her to support herself and her family after she'd been widowed. And I became fascinated with her because I taught excerpts from the Book of the City of Ladies and some other of her poetry in a course that was a survey course on women in history. And the students were fascinated that somebody in the year 1405 had written these incredible criticisms of what men had said about women. And really, revisioning history from a what you could call a kind of a pseudo or not pseudo, but a an early feminist interpretation to say, yes, women have contributed in literature, in art, in science, and in mythology, and let's tell their stories. And so it was because of that that I became interested in her and decided to write a novel that would feature her, though she wasn't the protagonist of the novel.
Yeah, I think you know, something that you mentioned really made me think that, you know, she does teaching her in that context does sort of like rewrite women's history, as you say, and also medieval history in interesting ways.
Yes.
Think of this period as like a dark age that is like intellectually bankrupt and culturally bankrupt, you know, and like they were producing really vital work that still seems, I think, like so ahead of its time today, you know.
Right. And from around the world because Charles V, which was the king that her father had been an aide to, had an enormous library in what's now the Louvre. And he collected books from, the East as well as the West. And that became really a very central part of her life. And it was part of what inspired her. She had access because of her father to the King's Library. And yes, it does really tell us a different picture. It's not at all just the Dark Ages, because these amazing works of art and science and so forth were being produced in this period of time. And women contributed to their production. And that's the important thing to underscore. Women were artists, they were scribes. They were people involved in the book trade in Paris, which was the center of the book trade in this period of time, besides Italy, I would say.
Yeah. Wow. So could you tell us a little bit then about crafting the dual timeline structure? Give us a little intro to Verity and to Beatrice. And, in terms of crafting the timelines, did you write them in dialogue with each other, or did you write them separately and then interweave them? Like, what did that structuring look like?
It's funny, and that's a great question, because I started out with a character in the medieval period who appears in the novel. It was just a vignette that I wrote about this 14th century priest, Father Baron, as a way of getting into life in the Middle Ages and what a young woman who named Beatrice might be doing to help support her family, and the family's fallen on hard times. And so that was the very kernel of the book. And then I thought, well, I really want to communicate something about time and the past in this novel. And to do that, I didn't want to just stay with the medieval period. I wanted to explore how somebody in the modern period could become fascinated with these books, and it becomes a gateway into medieval history. And not only medieval history, but as Verity, who's the modern protagonist, is exploring these books and the work of Christine de Pizan, she literally walks through stages of history of the past. And so we learn not only about medieval history, but the importance of those manuscripts for the 19th century arts and crafts movement in England under William Morris, for example, and the Pre-Raphaelites, who were fascinated with these designs. And I wanted to have a timeline that would be both modern and medieval and interweave them. And as I was writing, I would be writing a chapter in the modern period, but I wanted it to resonate with what was going on in the medieval period story. And so I did a little of both. I would write more about the medieval period and then something about the modern period and figure out how they intersected so that events would resonate in both sections.
So when you were writing that way, did you find that the story took you in directions that you didn't expect? Because that, like, did that sort of dialogue process, change the story as you were writing it?
It absolutely did, because you'd get to a point and I'd say, I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen next. And and in fact, I hadn't thought a lot about the importance of those medieval manuscripts to the William Morris and Pre-Raphaelite artists of that 19th century. And I discovered something in the course of the research that was literally an aha moment and allowed me to interject a twist and a turn in the story that, goes in a surprising direction, which reflected the surprise that I had about making that discovery in the course of writing. And I remember reading a lot of writers talk about how, your characters pretty much tell you where they want to go. And that happened in a surprising way. I wasn't sure where things were going. And then an event would occur, and a connection between the two timelines would sort of reveal itself, and it kept the momentum going.
That's so interesting. And I'm really fascinated by these moments in writing where, you switch from, to put it in sort of mystical terms, like you switch from telling the character who they are to them telling you who they are,
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the interesting things too that happened in the course of doing the research was I had to, eliminate a series of chapters that I'd written because I'd gotten so excited about going down this particular rabbit hole. And it was about the 14th century Venice, because Christine de Pizan was born in Venice when her father worked there for a period of time. And I wanted to write more about what was going on in that period. And then I realized, no, that's a different story. And I had to eliminate those three chapters. And yet the fascinating aspect of Venetian history that I discovered was about the prostitution trade, that there was a change in the law. And because men had done such an awful job of a corrupt job of in the prostitution industry, the lawmakers of Venice changed it so that women were primarily the brothel owners and managers, which was really fascinating and yet had nothing to do with this particular story, so it had to go away.
That's an experience I think that you get in academia and in novel writing. You just have all these hard-earned bits, that you want to include, but
Right, exactly. But you can't because they don't really work in the story.
So something else that emerges from the dual timeline structure and how the stories inform each other is a lot of really interesting points about women's labor throughout history and how that labor is often invisible. And I think that is just as true of the medieval book trade or writing culture as it is of modern academia. Like women get called on to do a lot of things that they are not recognized for. So could you talk about for the medieval bit, what sort of primary sources and secondary lit you looked at and drew on? And if there's anything that you encountered there that also sort of shifted your perspective and storytelling aims?
Right. I read scores of secondary sources on the book production industry, but I was also able, by going to the British Library, to consult some of the primary materials. I could not actually see what's called the Queen's Book or Harley 4431, which is a central part of the story. It was a compendium of Christine's writings that she gave to Queen Isabeau of France. Because it's such a rare book that only the most elite researchers or scholars of book history are allowed to have primary access to it. But it's all been digitized, and so you can actually see everything about that. On the other hand, I was able to see some other of Christine de Pizan's original works in the British Library, and that allowed me to get very, very close in a tactile way to the materiality of those books and to see the paintings that are in them. Because, of course, every part of a medieval book is handmade. And that's just an extraordinary thing to experience, so to speak, in the flesh when we're, in a different digital age now where so much of the reading we do is electronic. And that a tactile experience really shaped the way I was able to write about the books themselves. And in addition to that, I went to the Morgan Library and participated in a workshop there on medieval bookmaking, parchment making, and again was able to see some of these rare books from as far back as, in some cases, the 10th century. And so all of those experiences were part of what the primary sources, you would say, that I was able to have a connection to that helped me write about the book production industry in the medieval period. As far as women's labor is concerned, which is absolutely critical, there's been an immense amount of research by paleographers, and in addition to that, geographers who have used archival work that's extant in, for example, the Bibliothèque Nationale, the French National Library, to document the locations of actual artisans of the book trade in medieval Paris. And a map was made that I was able to find online through the help of a researcher in Canada. And that allowed me to literally locate some of the places where women scribes, women bookmakers, women artists were located in medieval France. And so a combination of a vast amount of research in the secondary literature, contact with scholars that I was able to communicate with through email and so forth, and these, you know, sort of primary experiences of touching the books, of learning how firsthand their parchment is made, ink is made, and so on. So it was an exciting, to say the least, research process.
Yeah, I'm really taken by your point about sort of having a tactile experience of the manuscripts. And it's a beautiful segue into my question about, you know, the differences between academic writing and fiction writing, you know, because oftentimes when we write historical fiction, we are trying to capture like the lived in details of everyday life that have only like in maybe like, you know, since in the mid 20th century kind of become like the concern of like researchers and historians. So, you know, there are all these like unrecorded, but very essential experiences that people had that you are trying to recover and sort of, so I love the idea of like touching and experiencing a real manuscript as sort of like method history, like a, you know.
Exactly. Right. There's method acting and method history.
Yeah.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, it's very, very different. First of all, since I published a number of books as an academic scholar, I had to unlearn that kind of writing. You know, you have to abandon the sort of jargon-laden way that academics communicate and find a more authentic voice. And an authentic voice for a character in medieval period, who's a Beatrice, who becomes Anastasia when she goes to Paris. She is renamed as a way of indicating her sort of rebirth. And the modern character's voice, Verity, has to be very different. So they have to be distinct voices in syntax, in the you know, the nature of the language itself. And that meant really obviously reading a lot of other literature about this period to get a sense for what the medieval voice might have sounded like without becoming too, say, arcane. And the other aspect of it is to get to the emotional experience of the character. You know, we don't do that so much. Academic writing is more, you know, supposedly more objective and distant way of talking about the past. But you want to really, as you said, get to the lived experience. What does it feel like? What does it smell like? You know, what would it have been like emotionally to experience the plague? I mean, we can now that we've experienced COVID globally have a sense of, my God, the panic that people must have experienced. But even more so because they had no understanding of where this disease was coming from and how quickly it eradicated, you know, what basically was a third of the population of Europe at the time. So how do you communicate that? Well, you have to find a language that's emotionally textured and is allowing the character to find a voice that communicates not only what's seen and heard, but what's felt in those times.
So talking about what is felt, you know, turning our attention to the contemporary timeline, this is a story that is both about medieval history, which we've been discussing a lot, and medievalism, which sort of you also have touched on about our sort of our changing relationship to medieval history and the sort of medieval cultural inheritance. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, Verity's sort of scholarly obsession? And I find tales of scholarly obsession so fascinating. And, you know, what maybe writing her fascination and obsession revealed to you about your own relationship to the medieval?
Yeah, that's a great question too. Yes, she starts out as a sort of French political historian. She's been working on the period of the 19th century with the women of the Paris Commune, who were very, very much involved in the rising up of the working class of Paris in 1871. And she wants to write about what it was like for those women, but she can't. She's sort of forced into an academic straitjacket and is ready to abandon the project. She's so disappointed with the way she has to tell their stories. And she goes to the Morgan Library and sees these these manuscript pages and becomes overwhelmed with how beautiful this material is. And what it sort of sparks in her is a sense that, my God, there's a portrait of Christine de Pizan, a page from one of her books. It's a portrait of the artist. It's so intimate in the way in which the writer is portrayed that she becomes convinced a woman must have painted that. And that becomes an obsessive, you know, concern of hers. And so she abandons what she was going to work on and sets off for London and then subsequently to Paris in search of some kind of evidence, some kind of trace that this woman actually existed. Now, parenthetically, I have to say, there is nothing known about the real artist Anastasia, except the name appears in Christine de Pizan's Book of the City of Ladies when she says, there's this an artist named Anastasia who's far surpasses any in all of Paris at this time. And that's the only clue I had to go on to create that medieval character. And it's the only thing that Verity knows about her. So how far is she going to go to prove her point? And where is she going to find any kind of real evidence that she can convince other people with that this was the woman who drew those paintings? And I'm not going to reveal whether she does succeed. You have to read the book to find that out. But an obsession, you know, it is really the case. You get so caught up in something you that you fully really believe, but you have to prove to others if you're going to, you know, verify your scholarly work. And, you know, it's a passion of hers. And I think it's an important thing to communicate about what it's like when you really sort of fall in love with your research and fall in love with your subject. And that passion takes over and drives you forward.
Yeah, and there's such beautiful resonances between the medieval timeline and the modern timeline in that regard. And I think sort of, you know, to get back to our previous point about like devoting yourself to labor that is invisible, you know, to
right, exactly.
Contemporaries and to history, you know, like it's a really, I think, a really beautiful and complex consideration of that. And thank you so much for sharing it with me and our listeners.
Thank you. You know, and it's the point you made about how it brings forward women's stories, women's contributions to history. And Verity is really intent on doing that, on showing that women were present in so many aspects of society, even in the medieval period. And we make all these assumptions that modernity is progress and women have it so much better. And in many ways, that's true. But it's also the case that there were women involved in so many areas of medieval society that remain unknown and often under-documented. And that's really part of what drives the story, to prove that.
And when you put it that way, you know, it becomes clear to me that like fiction can be a really interesting and vital way to recreate these histories that are lost to, you know, records that were written by elite men who were not
exactly
in those stories. So yeah, that's
and
really cool.
And ironically, that's exactly what Christine de Pizan did in the Book of the City of Ladies, was try to rewrite history from a different point of view.
Thank you so much for coming. It's been a delight to read this book and to talk to you about it. And you know, I was just wondering as a last question, what is next for you? Are you working on anything else right now? What's on your horizon?
Yeah, I've started another novel. There's another medieval book in it, but it's not the star that it is in Cities of Women. It's set in World War II, and it's about, and this is a factual case, the book that was discovered in the rubble at the end of World War II as part of the looted art that the Nazis had taken from Jewish households in, among other places, Paris. And a French soldier finds this book in the rubble, and I'm trying to write a story about who he was, what he did with it, and where it wound up in the end.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. And I would love to, you know, have you back to talk about that one when it comes to fruition. So I'm going to
thank you.
Out. Thank you.
Thanks, Jen. Thanks so much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Listeners, it's your turn now. Please check out Cities of Women. It is out now in the world, so you can find it at your favorite independent bookstore, your favorite library, your favorite internet retailer, wherever you like to go for books. Thank you so much for joining us. It is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.